many, many years later. Everything is always in motion. Nothing remains still. Despite what anyone says, history never, in fact, ends. Very little remains secret after 100 years. The origins of the enclave on Huntsie Island, renamed to honour the native people who lived and died here, are now well known. There had been a ridiculous accident. The kind of thing that happened in those ancient days when people had a strange religious belief in the protections of their all-seeing technologies. An early warning system had gone off much too soon and had sent three very powerful people to this beautiful place, cutting them off from the world. They had not known how to be found, and no one had known how to look for them. There had been a period of grief and searching, and then the world had shrugged and moved forward without them. Some historians suggested that the new movements, the change in the tide of thought, even the growing quasi-governmental powers of the future safe zones, had been a direct result of this disaster. The fact was that by the time the world discovered the truth, when FutureSafe sent the first caretaker group to live permanently on the island 41 years after the original accident, the puzzle was already, for most people, irrelevant history. Only one of the original three was still alive. Lenk Skettlish was old and confused. He asked the new settlers whether there had been a great cataclysm in the outside world. They told him yes, and he welcomed them to his island. It took a few months for them to understand who he was. He died within 3 years, and with him the living memories of the events on the island. Lenk Skettlish was buried in a place of honour, under a cairn of stones that was visible from the eastern windows of his mountain at dawn. It was another 38 years before the next generation of caretakers on the island discovered, through decaying recordings and rusted technologies, what had happened here. Ellen Bywater had died 2 years after the crash. Her assistant's suit had recordings of her talking to herself, or sometimes addressing her dead husband, Will. She became very disoriented, then very depressed. The suit had pleaded with her to try to escape, to contact the other people on the island for help. She had turned off its communication functions, leaving it a mute witness to her end. She'd taken the suit to the beach on the far north of the island. She'd left it sitting there, with its knees drawn up to its chest, staring out into the ocean. It had watched as she put stones into the many pockets of her lightweight flying suit and walked out into the sea. Later, it had recorded, with a troubled, partial 48% facial recognition certainty, the return, for a few days, of the body of Ellen Bywater to the shore, and the scuttling crabs and beetles and seabirds and bright green millipedes, their mouthparts working, that had helped the flesh that had once been her sublimate back into the living world from which she'd come. Exploring a distant cove accessible only by climbing down a crumbling cliff, the caretakers found the suit sitting there, knees up, arms wrapped around them, visor down, and recording the myriad parts of the living world that passed before it. Small birds pecked at its feet and at the tiny crustaceans that had latched to its heels in the sand. A rodent a little like a squirrel had taken to tucking soft seeds under its ass for safekeeping. It waited like that, its solar cells slowly failing, its residual power just enough for the barest flicker of monitoring functions. Zimri Nomik had died even earlier, but was found a great deal later. He had walked for 3 days to the farthest point of the island he believed to be nearest the mainland. He was sick, but he refused the suit's suggestions of reconnecting with the main party and accessing their medicines and assistance. The suit told him it could find extra stores of medicine, but he did not believe it. Instead, he found a cave and used his drone swarm to wall him inside a beehive cell with slabs of stone to protect himself from predators. The suit did all it could very loyally. It gave him all the drugs that might be useful. It monitored his fever as it spiked. When his heart began to falter, it shocked him back to life. It gave him morphine, so there was little pain at the end. When he was finally gone, the suit, like Ellen's, had no further instructions as to purpose. It continued to hold Zimri's body within its cocoon, lying on its side in a dark, concealed cave. The cave was warm and dry, its walls partly composed of salt. The sun was bright for months at a time. A shift in the stones allowed hot, parched air to circulate. As the body decomposed anaerobically, consumed by the very bacteria that Zimri had once carried on his skin and in his gut, the suit came to a decision itself to vent the noxious gases into the cave. It ventilated the corpse with the hot, salt air, and the body began to dry out faster than it could rot. Zimri's high-tech wicking sports clothes drew the moisture out of his corpse. After 8 to 10 years, the smell dissipated completely. The flesh that had mostly dried on the bones was a desiccated wire tangle of tendons and ligaments stretched tight over the skeleton. When the caretakers gently rolled the stone from the cave mouth, they found Zimri Nomik's dead face gaping through the faceplate at the sandy floor, without urgency or needs. Historians still debate the precise narrative of the accident that happened here. Toward the end of Ellen Bywater's life, the suit recorded several attempts at direct communication from her child, Badger, begging Ellen not to harm herself. When these recordings were found, they occasioned a great deal of debate. Could they possibly be real? Or were they some sophisticated deep fake Ellen had created herself to externalise her debate over the end of her life? If they were real, what did this mean about the accident on the island? Could Badger have somehow known where their mother was? And if so, why had they never spoken about it? By the point the recordings were discovered, Badger themselves was in their mid-90s, a parent of three with their long-term partner, the artist Gracie McCall, a grandparent and a great-grandparent. Of the original FutureSafe visionaries and board members, Martha Einkorn, Sela Nomik, Albert Dabrowski and Lai Zhen, Badger Bywater was the last survivor. They had by this time overseen the transfer of enormous assets in what had been Medlar, Anvil and Fantail to 58 independent FutureSafe territories. These territories were already well advanced in the process of allying to create the UAR, the United Autonomous Regions. The UAR was a distributed state, made possible by technology and the money technology had brought. A union of zones that had been dedicated, or had dedicated themselves, to the preservation of the natural world for the benefit of all humankind. Often, by using the proprietary technologies made by their founders to keep most of humankind away most of the time. All Badger Bywater ever said about the apparent recordings of them was that they didn't want to see their mother's last days. That it must be obvious that if Badger had been able to save their mother's life, they would have done so. It was a strange and upsetting time to live through, they said. Everyone knows how close the world came to disaster, the human race to extinction. I've read the theories about how my mother could have made those images herself, and they make perfect sense to me. She went through a terrible ordeal. She was confused. I wish it had been different. I wish she had been able to come home. I wish she had met my children. I can't see what there is to gain in raking over the past. The important thing is the future. Nothing can be permanently settled or solved. No state is perfect, no utopia exists but that it leaves someone out. All we can do is be alert, like Fox, to the changing winds. To ask ourselves in each new situation, what would we hate anyone to do to us? And who have we forgotten? To exist in motion, falling forward, trying to bend our own histories toward what is fair and kind, what is sensible and good. We will keep failing, but final success was never the point. North of Seattle, a woman is running through the forest. Over the tree-thronged miles, a paper and a stored tight-beam communication are folded in the top pocket of her shirt. The jackrabbits and the black-tailed deer leap and bobtail the road with the grace of wild things. Her dirt bike failed away back down the road. If they're not after her now, they soon will be. The United States of America does not appreciate the interference of the United Autonomous Regions in their affairs, and they would capture her as a spy and try her as a traitor if they caught her. The newly elected President of the United States is an Enochite. Pretending to be a fairly standard, moderate Fox and Rabbit movement person, she actually belongs to one of the more extreme wings of the belief. Her faction believes that the prevention of pieces is the moral duty of every one of God's creations, and that she must unite the world under a single world order. Starting with the so-called autonomous regions, whose militaristic and absolutist protection of wildlife habitats is a threat to the global order. It would be better, she has communicated via tight beam, for every one of the 1.2 billion citizens of the godless regions to die, rather than allow them to continue holding the world hostage with their empty mechanical suits and their swarms of drone gnats. The seceded regions must be reunited with their mother countries. The Basque Preserve must go back to Spain. The Cornish Zone must return to England. Kootenai and Flathead have to be part of the greater United States again. For fuck's sake. 15 miles ahead is an armoured survival suit that has buried itself face down in the earth around a hollow tree. If she can get there before sunrise, she will make the border of Haida Gwaii tonight with the information in her pocket. There is no other way to warn them. Any communication would give away her position. She runs through the night, more at home in the forest than she has been these long years in the city, believing in something strong enough to power her. The work is never over. There is no final battle. The fight is the destination, the constant tense balance between the present and the future.